Welcome to North Beats from North Beach. I'm your host, Corey Luna, chatting with the people behind electronic music. If you enjoy North Beats, please contribute at patreon.com/northbeats to help me fund this intriguing podcast. In the Bay Area, we have several live shows for you to attend. The first Sunday of each month is Resident Frequencies in Oakland, run by Kevin Friedrichsen. Second Tuesday is Resident in San Francisco, run by Frank Martin, Emery Peterman, and Jason Warden. The third Wednesday is Peaked, run by Rich Hogbend and myself. And a new open mic for electronic musicians is starting February 27th in Fairfax, Marin County, called Digital Grass, hosted at 19 Broadway and organized by me. This will be every fourth Thursday, so please come out. Admission is free, buy a drink, and support your local scene. If you have any questions, you may contact me on Instagram at CoreyZLuna or email me at CoreyLuna@yahoo.com. In September 2019, I interviewed my friend Lachlan Fletcher, who you may remember performed at Peak No. 4 with Mark Letzner. We get into his theories on music, and then we went to his practice space where we jammed for a little while. He played a Surge modular, and I played on Eurorack with Landscape FM's All Flesh touch plates. Last week at Peaked 11, Mark Letzner told me his mother listened to his North Beats podcast interview and loved it. So I'm happy to announce that North Beats is mother approved. Thanks, Mark's mom. Now, please enjoy Lachlan Fletcher. Thank you very much for doing my podcast, North Beats.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. So, tell me a little bit of a background on how you got into electronic music.
In high school, I had friends who had the types of older siblings that high school students think are really cool. And they gave us really low-quality MP3 copies of albums from, like a lot of Warp records, right? So, Boards of Canada was really big for me and my friends, and so yeah. It was Aphex Twin, and, you know, Future Sound of London, and all of this kind of, like, 90s British EDM kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Very much headphone music. And at the time, I was in bands. I played guitar and everything, and played a lot of like stoner metal, basically, was kind of an intense area of interest, with a burgeoning interest in shoegaze. I think those two are more related than maybe is immediately apparent all the time. Anyway, I mean, that's really how I got into it. I got a cracked version of Reason 4 when it came out, and kind of learned synthesis through playing with Reason 4, which is Reason is an amazing teaching tool about synthesis and electronic music generally. Yeah. And then I went to school for, in Montreal, I went to school for communication studies, which in my department and in many departments in Canada is a little bit different than it is in the U.S. It's kind of 50% cultural studies and media studies and 50% practice of that theory. And so what that looks like is there's a film school, and you learn about kind of how a film manifests the zeitgeist or is used culturally or received culturally, and then you go make film that kind of experiments with those ideas. So you can do film, you can do video, you can do digital arts, and I did sound. At the same time, I studied electroacoustic music at the same school. They had an electroacoustic program. So that is kind of what deepened my interest in kind of academic and experimental electronic music. So that was over 10 years ago, and it's been kind of my area of focus since in different ways. I've kind of taken a lot of different approaches to it. I've been in bands during that time. I've only played by myself for long stretches of time. I've played different instruments, but really over the last 5 years is when I kind of I learned the modular at school. They had a one of the years that I was there, they bought a four 84U9 or 84 84 HP 9U Dopefer cases. So wow. They had this like big Dopefer setup that basically had all the kind of like basics from Surge and early Moog systems and a little bit of Buchla stuff, like those modules. This was like 2008, 2009. So the lineup was smaller, like Dopefer's lineup was smaller than it is now. So I kind of learned modular synthesis then, and Reason has something to do with it, but I eventually was able to start buying my own system again after years of playing with different things in order to kind of create the music I wanted to create. But knowing the whole time that modular synthesis was the most effective way to get at the thing that I wanted to explore in music. So the past 5 years I've been focused on modular synthesis and kind of have been deeply immersed in that world for better or for worse.
Very good. So it sounds like from school you were able to expand a little bit more on what you understood of what synthesizers are. And how did you get into building the Surge?
So the first time I walked into there's a great store in Toronto called Moog Music. It's important. It is Moog. It's not Moog. It's very important for legal reasons that we all understand that it's Moog, not Moog, the shop in Toronto. They're not affiliated. And they have had issues in the past, but they're an amazing. I think everything is fine now. but they're fantastic. And I walked in and I was like, you know, I just really want to explore texture and timbre. I don't really want to make beat driven music or anything particularly melodic. I just know that these are like very powerful tools for doing this, and I've done this in the past. So give me like an interesting oscillator and an interesting filter, and. The person who was working there guided me away from that idea, and instead I walked out with a DPO and a Maths, which, you know, he kind of gave me a little bit of the history that we all know about West Coast synthesis, which I had never, you know, in school they didn't really teach that part of it. They were more focused
on... Sure they don't.
Well, it's kind of interesting because they taught a lot of other parts of the history of electronic music, but they didn't teach that part, yet they did have this system there. It was a funny choice. I think it just might have been that they hadn't updated their curriculum or something. But I certainly didn't know. Or maybe I wasn't paying attention. Also, incredibly likely. But I didn't know, and so this kind of blew my world. And having to go back and learn Maths, you know, and figure out in DPO like what even trying to wrap my mind around like musical applications for cross modulation, for example, was like a really good challenge. I think I've always kind of been invested in the idea of, so I'll come back to that point in a second, but I've always kind of been invested in the idea of creating systems, like instruments that are systems, that are kind of continuous. So I did a lot of like really loud, textural guitar looping in high school. Like this was post getting super into Boards of Canada, if that makes sense. I'm sure you can kind of imagine broadly what this sounds like. And then in university, I was in a band for a while where I played, this is very important. This band, which still exists today, it's called Aim Low. They're almost 10 years old. They're in Montreal and they are fantastic. When we started that band, the premise was kind of a parody. We all loved this kind of music. It was basically drone shoegaze without a drummer. Very like, what if Stars of the Lid was turned up to 11? I played a bass guitar with a violin bow through like a series of between 5 and 10 delays and reverbs feeding into each other, just to kind of like do this very, you know, not saying this was an original idea, but to kind of create this effect of the very Sigaros effect of just kind of like evolving sound, and you put input into the system, but then you kind of perform the system as much as you perform the bass guitar in this case itself.
Yeah, you're designing this arc of waves of different delays and modulation that you're playing with.
Exactly. So I would, you know, I was interested in that, and then I got really into kind of exploring destructive digital processing in ways that were like very interconnected. You know, changing the resolution of different audio files, actually messing with the audio files themselves, not applying effects to them, and seeing what would happen and creating textural music that way. And then after school, I spent a lot of time writing piano music. But that was also often through delay networks or really highly networks of resonant filters that would kind of create a harmony with the piano. So the kind of like idea of a continuous system that provides that responds to input and you can meaningfully perform has always been very important to me. And obviously, modular is a great way to do that. I got into Surge eventually. I only started playing the Surge about a year ago. Not even a year ago. A little less than that. I had, you know, as we do with Eurorack, have been in this process of I've definitely gone through the experience of selling, being like, Eurorack is not for me, and then I sold everything, and then I rebought almost all of the exact same things over the next year or so. Like I've gone through that process, and I'm continually swapping things in and out, and I was just like, you know, like I want to think about what I'm actually really responding to, especially the tools in the case that I would use for multiple different purposes, right? Like I'm not super interested in for myself. I'm not saying that this isn't. I understand why you would work in this way, and it makes a ton of sense to me. But for me, like I'm not super interested in having a filter that I use in this one specific way, or like it fills a role. You know, like I use this for bass sounds or something like that. That I want my tools to be kind of as flexible as possible. And so I was kind of thinking about, okay, well, what is really working for me? Well, I use this maths and everything, and I use the harmonic oscillator to drive all these different audio rate modulation systems throughout a patch. Particular kinds of filters that work really well with feedback. And so on and so forth. And I don't really patch in voices. Everything's kind of very connected. There's lots of kind of branching paths. This thing kind of like a break a signal off from its origin, combine it with another path, and then like it will go back to the first path or whatever, if that makes sense. If you're visualized like a river delta almost, the way that kind of like streams of water will intersect and reconnect.
Yes.
I try to patch in, I try to patch in that way to kind of like make it very interactive and bring things apart and back together and perform them in a way that sometimes you can hear them coming apart and sometimes you can hear them coming back together. And so looking at the toolkit and what I responded to really well, at this point I have two maths in my case. And
You're not the only one.
I know, absolutely. But it was, you know, it was data for me to be like, okay, that's working. And knowing that the way I patch is typically pretty dense in this way that has branching paths, Surge was kind of like, I was naturally very curious about Surge. It is highly optimized for this kind of patching, I think. And so that was a hunch, and I ended up finding somebody in, you know, in our community who had a Surge system that he wasn't using, and he wanted somebody to be using it. So we arranged a trade, and it has been very rewarding. It's hard to explain. I have this debate with Dorian. I wouldn't say it's a debate, but he pushes me on it, and I think it's good about whether or not. The Surge. I mean, we talk about the Surge specifically, but it's not really about that. But we talk about whether or not the Surge actually creates a meaningful difference in the work that I'm able to create. Because it feels to me like I do, but I'm also aware of the fact that all the tools I have in that Surge boat, I have in Eurorack, basically, as well. So, like, okay, well, what is the difference? And I'm sure that you could hear the difference between a 15 and a 12 volt modular system, but I don't think that that's like what the actual difference is. My hypothesis about it is that, and I think, you know, I suspect you would agree as somebody who thinks a lot about modular synthesis and about building your own, you know, instruments that you can really express yourself with. And we've talked before about how thoughtful you are about the sounds that you choose to put in. That has a lot to do with the tools that you're using, the sounds that you put into your compositions.
Absolutely.
I think the interface is incredibly important. Like the literal user experience of the instrument is incredibly important. It creates it's in some senses, like, the interface of the instrument creates an ontology. Like, literally, what is allowed to be music at this point in time? Because it steers you towards some things, it steers you away from other things, right?
Right.
I think about the piano as a really good example. The piano is physically imbued with Western music theory, right? Like, right. And they actually co-evolved together. And so there are certain things that are music that you cannot do with a piano. The piano guides you towards doing certain things that you wouldn't do with a guitar, vice versa, right? So, like, it kind of creates a world of possibility for you, even though you can, like, extend your technique and do all kinds of interesting things. And modular synthesis is, of course, extremely extensible. But the Surge layout does work in a particular way that I have found encourages me to create really dense patches that allows me to shuffle audio around the system in a much more flexible and immediate way. I also really appreciate, I don't think this is trivial, and it feels like a very privileged benefit. Like, talking about this feels like a very privileged place to be speaking from, but, like, the fact that it is, the panel is the panel, and you can't think about, well, what would happen if I swap this filter out, is super useful. That is so distracting for me, looking at my Euro Rack case and being like, but what if I change that? Like, I don't ever want to think about that when I'm actually making music. I only want to be thinking about the sound that's coming out of the speakers. So having everything laid out in a panel that is, like, a little bit monolithic to the 4U size is just, like, really satisfying to work with. And everything's in a grid on the Surge. It's just kind of, like, it feels kind of brutal and dense and efficient. And it just kind of, it has clicked with me. So I was telling you earlier that I have another Surge panel that I designed with Loudest Warning in the UK, and I'm excited to, like, get my hands on that. But I'm continuing to. This is, like, I guess, a new boat to throw my money into. But hopefully I will not keep expanding that system forever. I don't really plan on it.
Now, something that I'm not familiar with is playing a Surge. Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with it, know of it. I've never played one. Gotten into it and had the time taken, yeah. Invested in it and made a system. Tell me the differences that and what you like about it in comparison to, say, Eurorack or Buchla.
Mm-hmm. Buchla's a little easier. I've never played a Buchla other than, like, the Arturia.
Yes,
the easel.
Five.
Yeah, exactly. The
yes,
easel
I
plugin,
too.
Which is super cool. I've never even bought it. I just used the demo version. Oh, it was great,
yeah.
Though. Like, it was really satisfying
really
to use.
Yeah.
I think, I've used a lot of Buchla inspired things in Eurorack. I've had a number of 258 or 259 clones. Like, I've used a lot of them over the years. I do not have one right now, which I feel mixed about. Kind of the main difference from Buchla is obviously that, Buchla still has the audio cables and control voltages. Like, they're different signal paths, audio and control signal. That's a design decision that stems from the Buchla 100 and mm-hmm. continues to be true for everything that they release today. And it's very interesting. Like, it provides it's a great design constraint for them to have to create new things with. I think that it is part of what makes... It's a constraint that is, I think, very creatively productive for their instrument. But for what I do with all the kind of things running into each other, I really need everything to be on one standard, right? So the kind of, like, the Moog idea, the Eurorack idea that everything runs over one kind of cable and that you can run audio into any control voltage input and maybe it won't sound great, but you can at least do things with that.
Yeah.
So that to me is kind of... In terms of design philosophy, one of the reasons that I wouldn't ever, like, put a down payment on the Surge instead of a house, and instead I'm investing in Surge. There's a good documentary, I think it might be the Waveshaper TV documentary that recently went up about Surge himself, and Surge was talking about how he arrived at his design philosophy for the Surge, and it was basically he had been working on instruments made out of crude radio parts, I believe, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So he had kind of, like, learned all these. Do you know this story?
Not as much as you do. No.
I don't want to repeat anything that's boring, but he so he was working on these crude instruments, and then he saw a Buchla, and he thought it sounded really brutal and inspiring and uniquely electronic, right? in the way that, like, okay, this was a success state for the Buchla. The Buchla was designed to be something that was an inherently electronic instrument. It's not supposed to mimic anything else. And he had heard Moogs before, and he just wasn't that inspired by them. So he heard a Buchla, but he thought, okay, well, what if I put everything, you know, the Buchla modules are so technically complex. There's a ton of stuff happening under the hood. And he thought, okay, yeah, what if I take all of those things, all of the sub operations that are happening behind the Buchla panel that are abstracted, and actually put them on the surface of the instrument? So rather than, I think a really great example is, rather than having an LFO, you know, there's no dedicated LFO in a search system. You would use function generators to create that. And the original search systems didn't even have, like, the DUSG, or the universal slope generator that goes up. It's basically what MATS is based on.
Okay.
The original search systems didn't actually have slope generators that had both positive and negative slopes. They had positive slews and negative slews. And if you wanted to have both, you needed to patch them together. The whole premise of Surge is then, like, you are literally building your modules, right? You have a tool set to build whatever modules you need for a given patch. So everything's supposed to play multiple roles. The kind of, like, I think to my mind, and to many people's minds, the module that, like, most exemplifies that is the Stepped and Smooth generator, which is, it can do, Doug Lenner has this video where it's like, here's 22 things that you can do with this module. Here's, like, 22 completely separate functions that, depending on how you patch it, you have access to using this one kind of, like, 2-inch section of your surge, which is bananas, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this brings me to how I feel Surge is different than. So that's how Surge is different than Buchla, is that it does surface all of these things. And for me, that works really well. I like having kind of, I like experimenting with having really precise control over every timbral component, or like every component of the patch that's timbrally affecting the sound. And so it gives me this huge vocabulary to do that with, right? Like, even in a simple system, I have so many tools. Whereas in Eurorack, I end up kind of using the same tool for the same thing over and over again. And that can be great. That's a very interesting limitation. But it has been rewarding in Surge to be able to explore this other way of doing it. I think one of the differences, one of the reasons I wanted to make the jump, knowing that it was an investment, was that the Surge system is constrained, right? Like, increasing loudest warning, this person in the UK, Charlie, who's going to build this panel, he builds custom panels for people, Surge panels. He also kind of, like, developed a standardized format for you, format for modules that would be compatible with Surge. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you can get a rings in Surge format now, in the loudest warning format. So that does exist. And that's very cool. I'm not super interested in that. So, like, you can get those, and like, you can expand your search in this way. And there's people who are developing interesting for you modules, which is awesome. But I really love the idea of a constrained library of tools, you know, where, like, listen, unless you're buying, like, one of these extremely expensive STS surges, really, like, you have access to two filters plus the resonant equalizer. Like, and that's what you have. Everybody has access to those things. There isn't an infinite variety of filters you can choose from. There isn't an infinite variety of VCAs. The VCAs sound the way that they do. So I'm not ever going to think twice about, well, what if I had a different mixer? What if its clipping properties were different? Would that be interesting? And I will absolutely think about that. And I don't really want to, in terms of my music creation process. I love thinking about that as, like, an intellectual exercise. But in terms of being productive, I really enjoy the constraint. So the constraint of both locking the panel in and being like, okay, this is done, but also the constraint of, here's these, like, really brutal sounding kind of primitive electronic components that you're patching with, it just really works for me. And I don't know if it's something that I would recommend to everybody. Like, not to say that it's better or worse. I know that it works for me. That's all.
It just fits in the style that you like. And from what I understand of what you really appreciate about Surge is that there is the limitations of what's available. Is that, sure, you can do similar things if you're, you know, compared to Eurorack, but you don't have the same variety of tools that you would have in there. So, say, like you said, the LFO, There's not multiples. There's one.
Right.
And that's about, and that's what anyone in that system format is going to be using.
Right.
And it's up to you on how you're actually going to design your sound through these particular modules of that setup.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I think that problem would be solved in Eurorack if I had more self-discipline. Like, you know, I mean, I haven't bought any Eurorack. I've only sold Eurorack since I bought the Search, which is great. Like, I don't really want, I don't have space in my life. We live in San Francisco. Like, I cannot keep accumulating music gear. And I don't, it's also not the most fiscally responsible thing to do.
All our studio spaces are closets.
Yeah, exactly. I imagine that, like, realistically, you could make this, I think that you could end up with the same sounds. I mean, even on most of the Search tools, like most of the kind of like greatest hits of Search are available in Eurorack now. Which is great. So you could totally do it. It's not that you couldn't do that. It's just I can't do that because I lack the self-control necessary to build a Eurorack instrument that way.
It also creates a unique sound for yourself because you're using a system that has, you know, X amount and no real flexibility when it comes to the variety. But it gives you a space where you've already got a plan in your head of what you can do, what you want to do with these path, you know, with what path you're going to create, and having the intuition of knowing what module does what, you're able to continually, you know, create that patch and as you said, have the sounds filter back in from where they started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. That sounds exactly right. Much more concise. Thank you.
Oh, no problem. It's really fascinating stuff. I love how you've been able to break down Surge more for me because it helps me understand about it because I have yet to dive into it physically myself. But it's again one of those, you know, wonderful pieces of synthesizer history that I still have yet to really explore myself. You know, same thing with booklets. Like, I love the sounds of booklets. There's something particular about booklet, about any company, that there's a particular sound for every company, and I want a little piece of it somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I bought a Moog Minotaur just because I got it for a good price. It's a good you know, mono synth that does that, and now I have that ladder filter in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's very popular from Moog,
for sure,
which is great. But and you know, now I'm forever, you know, changing things up and trying new things, mostly in Eurorack,
mm-hmm.
of course. And just because it's just more affordable and it's just been a bit easier to deal with here and there. Now that I actually understand what I'm doing.
For sure. There's something, like, one of the really appealing things about Eurorack, but I also think working with music electronics generally, is, like, there is a really compelling element of collection. Right? There is.
Yeah.
It's an appealing thing to collect because it inspires and, you know, you can use them to access different kinds of experimentation, which is really cool. Where for you is the line between like collection and instrument building?
So for me, it's not so much about collection, although I have a lot,
mm-hmm.
in between Eurorack and pedals. I've got a lot of stuff, but I've been buying stuff for years, mostly, you know, pedals and just standard synthesizers. So I've got a decent collection at home, but my main focus has been Eurorack a lot over the past 2 years. So that's where I've been, you know, putting my main focus and learning about it. And something that I take away from it is rather not so much how many modules I have, but
mm-hmm.
what I can do with what I have. Because I don't want to continually buy more and more modules and make my system huge. Sure, it would be fun to have a wall, you know, the size of a library wall full of modules, but that's just not in the, you know, not in the cards right now.
Mm-hmm.
So doing a smaller set and also living in San Francisco, something that I wanted to do, that I've set out for, and I've mostly been able to do, was set up between either 104 HP or 84 HP SCIF,
mm-hmm.
and have everything I want to use in that
mm-hmm.
one setup, so that I can take it on the bus and go play a show.
Mm-hmm.
That way I don't have to worry about carrying a few suitcases worth of things. So it's easier to get around that way, and I'm able to constrain myself to the amount of modules I buy. This way I tell them I can practice on what I have and decide on where that sound's going. And then I can decide on how I'm going to tweak it, how mm-hmm. I'm going to rechange that patch. So it's a good tool to limit yourself, because that gives you the opportunity to really understand the modules that you have and the limitations that they are and how much you can push them.
Yeah. How often do you change the modules in your performance case?
Not a lot. Yeah. I just changed up this 84 HP case just earlier this week. So this is actually designed more around the twin cushion module I just got from Vermona, which is brand new. I've only played with it once. But before that, I had all kinds of crazy things in there, and I really only have... There's really only four modules in there now.
Mm-hmm.
Just because Renee is huge, mm-hmm. and then Twin Cushion is almost... Not quite as huge, but it's a big one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they take up... I think there's 50% of that case is just those two modules.
Yeah.
They're just huge.
So I take it that you do not fall on the... save all the HP you can. You don't fall into the save all the HP you can camp.
No.
Yeah.
No, I'm not worried about it.
Yeah, me neither.
No, it's like, if I need more HP, I'll get a new case, but I've got two cases that I switch around with. I really only want to take one out of the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, I've been able to do that. Like, last time I played Resonant Frequencies, I brought this guy out, and I was able to do a set for, I think I played for 25 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and I had a ball doing it.
Right.
It was fun.
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. I would imagine that the simplicity makes it, in many ways, I found the more complicated my setup is, if I'm not super rehearsed, the worse the show is going to go. Like, a simpler number of points of interaction, obviously, is going to guide you towards probably a more coherent performance.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of these things with modular or music gear in general, where, specifically the HP question with modular, I get it. Like, if you're writing music that is where part of the premise or kind of the artistic intent is to make use of a large number of voices, saving HP is actually a really important part of the design of your instrument. I get that for sure.
Sure.
So I don't mean to... It's just an interesting case study of there is no inherently better... there's no like inherently superior way to think about laying out your instrument. So I happen to identify with you, like, get the tools that really speak to you,
mm-hmm.
that when you touch them, you are able to do all kinds of different things, even things that you weren't expecting that are pleasing to you, and then learn to play them by constraining yourself to interacting with them.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
It's really fun that way. Something that really, I'm not sure if, I don't know if you can do this with Surge,
mm-hmm.
I guess it depends on the inputs, but something that I really enjoy using are the Landscape FM All Flesh, which are basically just...
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
I do, yeah.
They're fantastic. It's basically you're using your body as a patch keeper.
Mm-hmm.
And if you set it up right with the right, you know, module, you can make it a percussion.
Right.
And just at the touch of mm-hmm. your finger, basically. And you can send different signals to different places all at the same time,
mm-hmm.
if they're close enough in proximity to your fingers, of course, if you're stretching long enough. And it's been a really interesting tool to play around with and actually perform with.
Yeah.
Because it actually gives you a little bit more versatility, you know, similar to a keyboard,
mm-hmm.
but it's not exactly.
Yeah. Okay, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Based on this, I saw you post a video of this case.
Yeah.
This performance case that you have that is also sitting in front of me right now, I'm gesturing towards it. But and you had the what are they called?
All flesh.
Yeah, patched in. I thought that was super interesting because you had a lot of them too, which indicates that you are obviously making really great use of them. But my question is, so you are turning the interface of the modular synthesizer into something that is really a
more playable.
Yeah, has a tactile interface,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is an interesting topic in electronic music, in electronic instrument design. Is instrumentalism important? You know, or what is the value of instrumentalism? So you're developing a physical technique,
mm-hmm.
in order to interact with your synthesizer, and that physical technique is we talk about like the ontology of a musical instrument, like that you have the piano, you have the keys and the specific frequency ranges and all these kinds of things, right? Your version of that is, okay, well, you have these pads and they're going to respond to touch in a particular way, right? So right. You are learning how they react to you. Mm-hmm. Similarly, you have Renee. Renee has certain optimizations and constraints. To you, like, is performing with an electronic instrument that is very physically responsive, is that inherently more rewarding? Are you more excited when you see other people playing, or do you care? You know, do you want somebody else to be doing something that's very physically performative? Or if you see somebody kind of work a patch that's much more programmatically generated, is that equally exciting to you?
It's more personal for me.
Yeah.
That to be able to use the flesh plates to interact with the system more in a more theatrical way, mm-hmm. I think is something that I've wanted to incorporate into, you know, a live show, and I actually have more of a connection to what I'm doing,
mm-hmm.
you know, with modules by playing them with my fingers,
yeah.
compared to, you know, patching everything and it all being, you know, generative,
uh-huh.
which is fine. You know, there's plenty of people who are doing that. You know, there's plenty of people who are still, you know, using laptops and, mm-hmm. you know, playing a set like that. That's fine. That's what they want to do, you know, but that's not for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of varieties of how to play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people don't want to use a computer interface at all. Some people just want to have it all just, you know, patch cables. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that works for that artist, that's great. Me, I like a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So currently I don't have, you know, any type of computer set up with it really at all, just everything that's in the case. But it just gives me something that's a bit more physical, that gets me more into the music of what I'm doing. And it is a part of theatrics at the same time, mm-hmm. is that you can actually, you know, get into it as if you're playing a keyboard, and you can, you know, put yourself into the motions of the music a bit mm-hmm. more that way. And I think that's something that's very expressive mm-hmm. for an audience.
For sure. For sure. I think I completely agree with you. I think that this is a theme of our conversation. Right? We don't need to. It makes me really tired when people decide to talk about one approach being better than the other one. Like, that's not what we need to be doing.
No.
And in fact, I think that when people are talking about that, what I kind of hear is wanting to center the conversation about making music on gear rather than on actual composition. Which is a real bugaboo for me. Like, the gear is really important. You know, we've been talking about gear, obviously. Like, I think it matters. Not that I'm saying that I'm right, but I do think it matters. So it's not that I'm questioning that premise. But like, if what you're hung up on is you didn't build your instrument or you're not performing in the right way, you're thinking not about the actual music. You're thinking about, you're like doing some weird gear gatekeeping that isn't useful or conducive to creating a better music scene, working together with the people around you to kind of all collaborate to make each other's music better, right? Like, what are we doing if we're not doing that? Let's focus on those things. The gear is important. It's a part of it. But if we're gonna talk about how your performance went, let's talk about how the music actually sounded first and work backwards to whether or not what you did with the gear was effective. You know, but start with the result.
Something that I think you and I both agree upon is the philosophy that it goes behind creating music,
mm-hmm.
that goes behind every artist that is using some type of synthesizer or any gear of any sort, is that what's your approach to mm-hmm. this? And that's something that I've seen with everybody within our electronic music scene here in the Bay Area. That we play with at Resident Frequencies and mm-hmm. Resident and it peaked as well, and which has been a great audience because everyone's coming about, and when I look around the audience, people are listening with their ears.
Mm-hmm.
They're closing their eyes and listening to what's happening. They're not worried about what the performer's doing exactly. Mm-hmm. It's there because they're interested about what this music is. And again, it's all about our approach.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about, it's sure, the gear is definitely a huge part of it, but it's also about how we internalize that music and how we internalize our gear and what we want to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because every artist has an expression of what they're trying to convey.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody has a focus mm-hmm. on that. Some others do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge part of our community and how it grows.
Mm-hmm. I had a really interesting conversation with a mutual acquaintance of ours, who is, I'm not saying his name because I don't know if he uses his real name on music releases that he does.
Okay.
but he's really interested in, his primary interest in electronic music actually is the interface itself. So he does a lot of DIY stuff. He really likes experimenting with new kinds of control modules that are coming out and thinking about workflow in different ways. And that is the thing that is kind of most stimulating for him about the experience of working with the modular synthesizer. It's related to what he does at work. He's naturally gravitated towards those kinds of thinking in his life, and so it would make sense that it extends to the way he's approaching his music. And it's not that the music itself isn't a priority, but when he's thinking about what his next project is going to be, it's going to be exploring a new way of making music and then kind of like applying that to familiar sounds. The evolution is in the workflow. It's not necessarily always... The goal isn't to create evolution in the music. Music does evolve, but it's kind of in response to the workflow, if that makes sense. And that totally makes sense, but I think that's... this is maybe slicing a hair. We'll see. I think that this is different than the kind of failure mode that we're describing of... not having an artistic perspective that's powered by gear. He does have an artistic perspective that's powered by gear. His artistic perspective is about gear, if that makes sense, which is a little bit of an Ouroboros, but that to me is still different from I have this piece of gear and I use it in the way that kind of is extremely characteristic of that gear, and I'm not really thinking about how to bring it together in a way that creates a coherent artistic vision. Not to say that that's not fun to do sometimes. Like, it totally is fun to do. but the community that I want to be in is one that is able to do that, but then also when we get together to talk about our music, we're talking about the differences and the similarities in like compositional terms in its own right and being enthusiastic about it, to your point.
Years ago, there was this bumper sticker that came out, and it still floats around here and there. And it says, "Drum machines have no soul." And I don't think it's stayed very popular.
Yeah.
Because to me, it's like, well, you're putting your soul into that drum machine when you program it.
Uh-huh.
And into anything that you're playing, you're putting your soul into those modules,
yeah.
putting your soul into that guitar,
mm-hmm.
whether it be, you know, or that piano.
Yeah.
All these things are expressive tools,
mm-hmm.
and I can understand the perspective of someone who's who would use that bumper sticker because they're probably a drummer,
mm-hmm.
and they're seeing it as taking away the human aspect
mm-hmm.
of what they do, which I understand, but at the same time, it's a different perspective of how you create music. It's a tool, and you choose how you use that tool. And most bands will have a drummer if they have guitars and basses and things like that, even a synthesizer, sure.
Yeah.
But it creates a sound.
Yeah.
Look at bands like Depeche Mode.
Mm-hmm.
That's a band that doesn't use a live drummer usually,
mm-hmm.
or at least on the recordings.
Yeah.
It's all, drum machine,
mm-hmm.
like that. Beastie Boys,
yeah.
right on, right, again.
For sure. I have a slightly different perspective on this. Okay. I agree with you that is a layer of for sure what is happening, but I also think that anytime, I mean, this isn't specifically about music. I think anytime that people are using, rejecting technology in particular, but like anytime somebody is rejecting something cultural, really what they're doing is just trying to like signal in-ness with some other group, right? And right, create community by deciding who isn't in the community.
Yes.
And so I think it's all about social capital, which is a real bummer that like musicians do end up accumulating social capital by doing this thing that you're describing, which is just like deciding to write off
mm-hmm.
Entire
technology.
I mean, an entire technology, but also just, I mean, it's just such a bummer as an artist to write off somebody else's art, mm-hmm. kind of not super critically. I think that you're not doing yourself a service, right? If you have a practice of whenever you hear something, even if you don't relate to it, trying to figure out what works about it, or what you like about it, or what you could like about it, you will be a better musician if you take that approach, rather than disregarding things because they are not kind of like
the status quo,
or they don't kind of, you don't see them as helping your status, right? Like, which is, you know, it's,
yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. I feel very fortunate that in the Bay Area, that doesn't seem to be what the conversation is around electronic music. And I think that dates back to the conversation about Serge and Buchla, right? Like, Serge and Buchla got along okay, it sounds like. I don't think either of them were one of them is alive, the most social dudes. But they I don't know if they really necessarily saw themselves as in competition. I'm not sure. I'm going to retract this statement. But the point is that coexisted. There was a general, the kind of like ideas around Surge. The Surge community still is like really accepting. And it's because like Surge, there isn't, to my mind, maybe there are people who disagree with me, but I don't think that there is a Surge music in the way that I would say that there is like a Buchla music.
I agree.
Or there's something that sounds characteristically Buchla or Moog.
Yeah, no, I see that actually. I've seen that in the community quite a bit. That mm-hmm. there, especially with Buchla, like mm-hmm. with the Music Easel.
Yeah,
there's a particular group that you know get together, and that's a thing.
And that's super cool.
I think it's great. You know, there's people that actually design cards so that you can program. Right?
It's super cool. It's great. It's and like there is a lot to having a community based around an instrument. That's really lovely. And that is what is happening with Surge. It's not that that's not what's happening with Surge. But the people who are involved in the Bay Area electronic music community, who, you know, I think like Doug Litter, for example, mm-hmm. who is fantastic and super welcoming and shares his knowledge. And he is somebody who absolutely will figure out what works about what you're doing. Like, he has a great ear and a great mind for it, and he's like a kind of a good mentor. But then that there's all kinds of people who've been doing this that we know in the Bay Area for a really long time, and they all kind of share that characteristic. And it's just tremendous. Like, I feel very fortunate because I've been in scenes in other cities where it's not that they were bad, but they weren't as curious or like just inherently interested in what other people were doing. Not that that always happens here, but I think it happens here a larger amount of the time than in some other scenes that I've operated in.
In my experience over the past couple of years, I really have seen a big welcoming to electronic music,
mm-hmm.
whether I'm in Seattle or Portland or somewhere else, but of course in the Bay Area, everybody is very accepting. And I had this great conversation with Ellison Wolf, who does Waveform Magazine, when I went to Seattle last month. And he even mentioned, he said, have you noticed that there's no big egos with mm-hmm. anybody? Everybody's just really curious about what else we're all doing, about the technology, and we're all open to help each other out.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's one of the most wonderful things I've really appreciated about this whole electronic music community.
I do have a hypothesis about one thing that leads to that culture. Obviously, really what makes it work is that it has attracted people who want to continue propagating that culture. I think that we need to prioritize bringing more kinds of people into those discussions that are very, you know, we know that we are an accepting group, but unfortunately sometimes that's not enough to increase the diversity of thought and identity. So I think it's something that we all need to focus on. But I think one of the things that binds us together, despite the fact that, one of the reasons that we do tend to be pretty open-minded with each other and supportive, is that nobody's doing the same thing. There's no genre. Like, this isn't punk rock, you know, where you could go see like a really scene-driven show and see four bands that are doing really similar things, and that's awesome, right? Like, there is a lot to that. But the fact that we are not like that, everybody is doing something that, like, has a... Oftentimes, you go to see a show like Resonant Frequencies, you will see 10 different artists who had 10 extremely different artistic intents. And they're using tools that are really only superficially similar, right? Like modular synthesizers, it's like we all love and appreciate them, but when you actually look at the way that somebody's instrument works versus somebody else's instrument, they're extremely different.
Yes.
So there's all of these differences, and it's only these superficial things that's kind of like interested in the gear ostensibly that brings us together. But because we all, like, we as human beings, we thrive on a social element, right? And, and we want to listen to music, we want to have our music heard. We are in a scenario where we are highly incentivized to actually listen to each other and be engaged with music that maybe you wouldn't hit play on otherwise. I think one of the things that I really, I try to make sure that I do, and I hope that we continue to kind of build a culture of this, is anytime that somebody that I know personally has released something, I try to listen to it at least 5 or 6 times. Even if it's not something that I'm going to like have in my back pocket to jam out to personally later, I just want to hear it. I want to offer the support of having really heard it and thought about it. Mm-hmm. Because it's a real shame. There's a lot of very cool music that's being made, and I feel like it's sent off into the ether and the internet, and nobody ever listens to it.
That's a big dilemma I'm seeing. And I think that's something that we're slowly trying to figure out together. Like, some people, like Nathan Moody, he's already very well established, and when he puts something out, it's well received, because he's Nathan Moody, everyone knows, and which is great. But we don't always all have, you know, that background. So there's some of us who are putting albums out,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I got you know, a case at home of cassette tapes I put out earlier this year. I've sold a few, not much,
right.
But you know, I'm doing a different thing as well. You know, maybe it's not as well received audibly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But again, it's something that, as you said, it's, you know, you put it out there on the internet and it's to the ether.
Mm-hmm.
It just, no one's going to hear it if you're not promoting it, if you're not out there doing shows to promote it, things like that, which is the old school way, which still works.
For sure.
You know, and speaking of albums, I was listening to Beatitudes,
mm-hmm.
your album, and I was really digging Vancouver number one.
Mm-hmm.
That was a nice granular piece.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's very kind to say. I can talk a little bit about that, but I think a lot about, you know, I have a job that is not music. I don't really aspire to make music my job at any point in time. You know, if someone were to like show up and be like, we will give you millions of dollars, or we will just pay you a living wage to make music for the rest of your life, I'd be like, great, cool. But I'm not going to go try to make that happen. I don't know very many people who are actually doing that, who love their work. And I don't think that I have the emotional resilience to do that job, like to do the job of being a musician. So it's not a goal that I have. And that means that my goals as a musician are to make music that I find rewarding to listen to and to make, that is like intellectually stimulating, that is emotionally stimulating, that I really like the practice of holding myself to a really high compositional standard and trying to get better every time I pass the synthesizer. And when I record things, trying to kind of like get the version of it that is the best possible thing it could be, and to get better as a composer. Like that is really important to me. And then when I share it out, I don't need everybody to listen to it. Like I don't want to spend the time on marketing that would be required to get lots of people to listen to it and to hear me. And I don't really care. Like, I'm fine with that. I need somebody to hear it. Like, it's not that I don't want people to listen to it. I find it very rewarding when people listen to it and enjoy it. But I also know that there's like, you know, I have maybe 20 people in the world that I will send this out to, and they will actually listen to it a few times. And that's cool. That like works for me, as long as they listen to it and they give me honest feedback about it. That feels pretty good. I'm not saying that this is obviously not a good way to become a professional musician. I'm not trying to, but I think a lot about, you know, I guess I get insecure about like my own validity as an artist if I'm not trying to get more people to listen to it. Like, maybe I'm a little in my own head, but like, is it just a defense mechanism against people not receiving it well? Is that one of the reasons why I'm not out there pushing it? Well, I mean, it is true that I don't want to live the lifestyle that people who are working professionally in music have to live, or that I've seen them live. I'm sure there's ways that you could do it on your own terms. So yeah, I think about that a lot. I don't think that there's an answer there, but I do think about it constantly. So Beatitudes was something. I wasn't really planning on making a record, and I realized that I had enough tracks to turn it into a record. So I kind of like took all these recordings from a period of about 18 months, and where I hadn't really been artistically very focused, but I had been developing. Like I had been working really hard on trying to figure out how to get more out of the synthesizer and how to create real compositions and not just interesting sounds. Because I had my first couple of years working with the modular were really just like making cool sounds, right? And like it was very enjoyable, but I wanted to kind of like, you know, take the next step. And it had been a while since like the previous release that I had made was piano music. And so I hadn't like written anything in a while. I hadn't like put an energy into actual composition really since like a few years prior. And I didn't like make that record with a ton of intention. And a lot of that record, one of the reasons it sounds very granular is that I used the modular as a sound source, but I didn't really do the composition in the modular. So a lot of it isn't very performed. Make a sound, maybe tweak it a little bit, and then I would go back in and kind of use them as like several minute long samples, mm-hmm. and do a lot of repitching or layering things at different pitches, like similar to the things I had been doing years prior with destructive audio processing. And at the time, I was using the demo version of Ableton Live Suite because I didn't want to pay for it. And so you can't save anything. So what I would do is I would record some sounds in, and then I would like do some processing to it. And then I would internally route it in Ableton because you can't bounce either. I would internally route it in Ableton through a bus back onto an audio track, yeah. and record, like basically bounce it down that way.
Sure.
And then the next day when I went to work on it, I would open up a new session and bring that track in. So I would just be working from whatever stereo stem I had ended with the day before. And so I would kind of like work in layers because I couldn't save. And it was actually a fantastic constraint. But it created, on the pieces that are a little bit more compositionally dense, it did create a real sound. And that ended up being the thing that characterized it. I realized I had made all this music in this way without really having tried to. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of how that record came about.
That's great. Well, thanks for telling me a little bit more about that album. I was really curious to hear more about it, and I noticed that you had said you've stated on your Bandcamp that you said don't pay me, donate $10 to an organization or uh-huh. something like that, and that's a nice thing to do.
That's for a couple of reasons. One, I'm genuinely not trying to make money from my music. I don't have to. Fortunate to have a job that means that I don't really have to worry about. I can like have this hobby, and I feel very fortunate that I don't have to monetize it. That's great. It kind of like makes me less stressed out about it, very selfishly. But then two, I'm an immigrant, so I'm from Canada, and
I saw that.
I'm on a work visa, so I can't make money for my music. And I just like beyond, you know, I do genuinely feel like people have told me that they've done this. I recommend specifically donating to charities that benefit First Peoples and especially queer and queer people, trans people, and women in First People and Indigenous communities. Because I don't know. That's just like I'd love hearing when people are like, I liked your music and so I did this thing. I contributed to this cause that I normally wouldn't have contributed to.
Well, you're obviously passionate about really these good. Things.
So it feels that is much more meaningful to me than having received like $10 for the record. So I do it for both reasons, but also like genuinely, if for whatever reason I'm ever renewing my work visa or something and the customs agent asks me, well, you have this music online, I can say, no, look, like literally, you can't pay me. I told them not to. Like, I don't have a bank account connected to Bandcamp. I do not receive, like, people sometimes do, like, send a dollar or something and I just don't collect it. I don't know where it goes. I don't want to find out. Like, I just don't want any of the complications.
Okay.
This is the same reason I don't have my music on Spotify, because I would have to do it through Canada and I don't want to deal with it.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's something that I have yet to even try to get on is Spotify. I haven't even tried at all. Yeah. Like, it's something that Frank Martin keeps on telling me, mm-hmm. you know, put my music on there, put my podcast on there. Yeah. Like, haven't got around to it. It's like, yeah. Don't really want to. At the same time, I probably should.
It's a weird gatekeepery system. Like, it is. I listen to music on Spotify, like, all day. Like, I don't even really feel mixed about it. I think it's fine. But the way that... I understand why... Like, you have to basically pay somebody to get your music on Spotify. Spotify approves the people who can put music on its platform. And if you're Spotify, that makes sense. But it's kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
You know? Especially, like, yeah. Do you want to time... You also, you know, you have your job that you have to go do during the day. You only have so much energy. You know, you have a relationship that you maintain. You have a social life.
Yeah.
Do you want to spend your time dedicated to music trying to, like, work with some kind of, like, shitty automated program that's trying to put your music on Spotify and probably not doing a great job? And definitely the people who work at that company don't care about you or your music. Like,
yeah, it's not that...
I don't want to spend my time and energy on that.
Only that headache.
Yeah. And I get it. I don't think it's that hard. Like, I'm being way overly dramatic about it, but but this is, I guess, one of the ways that I justify it to myself.
I had a fun enough time figuring out Bandcamp, the difference between the fan and the artist profiles.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, now I finally figured it out. It took a minute.
Yeah.
That was kind of hard, but that's not too bad. I got it up. I figured it out. And then actually something that I learned from Caleb Duarte, who is an audio terrorist, he actually told me something that I didn't know about. He said that you can actually, that he does all the time, is that you can upload things, you know, tracks to Bandcamp and leave it open to upload more or take them down, and you don't have to publish it right away.
Yeah.
And that's something that I've now been using just for personal use.
Oh, cool.
Which has been really great.
Kind of like accumulate your work there. Exactly. And then when it's ready for release.
Put it together, listen to it in unison, decide if it's right. If not, take a track or two down or something like that, rearrange things.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a pretty flexible platform.
Mm-hmm. I really like Bandcamp. I just wish that their app was, like, a little bit easier to use. And, like, I get why. Like, they are trying to guide people towards actually buying the music, which Spotify is not doing. And so, like, good job, Bandcamp, but it does make it slightly more inconvenient to listen to.
I actually use Bandcamp more than anything else.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
We should all take a page from your book, I think.
Like, I like Bandcamp the most out of, like, all the music apps out there. I'm forever exploring, listening to things I would never hear of. And that's something that's really great. And compared to, say, like iTunes, I use it just because it's like the main thing on my phone to listen to music, but I'm not a fan of how it's designed. Just have never liked it. It's just one of the things, especially on a computer, it just takes up so much memory. And it's just ridiculous. But
Bandcamp's blog is really good.
Yeah.
I think, like, they do a great job digging into sometimes, like, hyper local scenes and pulling up 10 records of this extremely specific subgenre from some specific region. And it's all really cool. Like, you know, even if you don't end up walking away with a record that you're going to listen to over and over again, they do a good job writing about these people that are not getting written about otherwise.
That's great.
It's awesome. Like, they post them on Twitter and they don't get enough engagement, which really, it makes me sad because it is a very cool kind of music journalism that they're doing. Yeah.
That's fantastic. I gotta look into that. Thank you. Well, we've talked for about an hour. I think we're pretty good.
Cool. Thank you so much. This was fun.
Yeah, this is... I think